Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Seats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
At the end of the 100 days, there's a press conference that is where all the press come in and they sort of grill the president about, well, this is the 100-day mark. Now, what have you accomplished? And one of the questions was, what was the most enchanting thing about your first 100 days at the White House? And I saw him later that day, and he said, Bill, I swear to God, I was tempted to say the pastry chef, but he said, I knew I'd have to call a second press conference if I said that.
Back in the studio, where I find myself sitting across from the Obama White House pastry chef, Bill Yosis, who is going to tell us about Michelle Obama, working with her on her Let's Move initiative. Is that what it's called, Let's Move?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And your new book, which is called The Sweet Spot, Dialing Back Sugar and Amping Up Flavor. So, you know, when we last left you, you were telling us about working for President Obama, but you didn't really talk about Michelle Obama, who was very involved with food.
Very true. Absolutely. It was an incredible experience to work for both of them, and two very different personalities and two very different sort of ways of looking at the world, but in harmony, certainly. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Obama had not moved into the White House for more than, I think, 3 weeks before she asked for a meeting with the chefs. And now, remember, she's got kids in a new city, a new school, can move the furniture. The husband has this awesome new job.
That's kind of all-consuming.
It's all-consuming. But she took the time and said, you know, sat down with us and said, you know, for me, when I was campaigning with Barack, and, you know, and I noticed that the kids were not, you know, we couldn't get great food on the table, so she hired Sam Cass, who bailed right. them out in a great way and cooked for them. And she said, I determined then that if, you know, I was having a problem, you know, feeding the kids well. Other people probably are too. And I want this to be my signature issue. And we want to plant a garden, and we want to use that garden as a symbol of better eating, taking care of yourself, and exercise too is an important part of it because of just the general overall health. So children's health.
And did you get the feeling that this came from her and not from one of her staff members?
Oh, it was her, no question. Yeah, because her own kids had, you know, the girls were, what, I don't know, 7 and 10. And so, you know, you're already like forming the habits that you have for a lifetime food-wise. So she wanted to be sure that they were on the right track. And she was already very well informed about levels of diabetes and obesity. And this was, you know, especially in disadvantaged neighborhoods, it's a huge problem. So I was thrilled. I had just come from working with Michelle Nichon, who is the poster boy for this.
Right, for healthy eating. Michelle's been on the show.
Oh, and terrific.
And he had that restaurant up in Westport that Paul Newman financed.
The dressing room. I was the pastry chef there. That's where I left to go to the White House. So I was like, full circle, this is amazing. And it never stopped being amazing. I was just honored to and excited to be involved. The garden, the first year, I don't know if you know this, do you garden? Do you have an experience?
No, I'm supposed to be learning to love gardening. My wife really wants me to learn to love gardening.
It is addictive. But the thing is, you get your first year free. I don't know, that's why I say, I don't know if you know this. So you see what, you go out and you turn over the dirt and you plant a bunch of things. They come up. It's like beautiful.
And it's magic.
It's magic. There's like everything. But the reason is the pests haven't discovered you yet. The fungus, the bacteria, the pests, the nematodes, I don't know what they are. But they don't know you're there. They don't care. All that was there before was just dirt and grass.
They're just trying to get you hooked on gardening.
And then the next year, all chaos breaks out. There's like monsters everywhere. Anywho. So the first year we were all quite proud of ourselves, like, you know, 1,200 pounds of vegetables, like Sam and I were like strutting around. And then the second year was a little more difficult, but it never stopped being fun. And we, you know, was it's everybody got into the act. There's a lot of interns, which mm-hmm. is something that was a really wonderful thing to do, especially during those years.
Interns, even in the kitchen, out of the kitchen,
not
everywhere.
In the kitchen. No,
okay, just, got it.
I mean, they're policy interns mostly, but they were allowed to come and volunteer to help us maintain the garden, and so like twice a week we'd take them down there. And then I started. Mrs. Obama asked me to start a program of inviting children from local schools to tour the garden, which we started. We did that twice a week. It was great fun learning about pollinators and root systems and photosynthesis, all that good stuff. As you can see, it was just a fantastic period
it
in
must
my
have,
life.
Like, and, you know, there's people that are fortunate enough to be doing something at a moment when something just explodes onto people's consciousness. I mean, I felt that way actually at the beginning of Serious Eats. You know, it's like because everyone, you
Very
know, my
true.
Old media friends were like, what are you doing? Like, are you crazy?
Oh, the
you
internet.
Know? Yeah, the internet. Like, isn't that what you do when you can't find a job? You know, and but I remember that first year mm-hmm. of the Serious Eats office, and the energy was just incredible. Like that, it was palpable when you're part of something mm-hmm. at that stage, and you must have felt like that.
Truly, yes, definitely. That you just the looks on people's faces, and you know, as I say, this had Alice Waters had been around for 20 years, Michelle Nichon, other sustainability proponents. But to have the First Lady's office talk about it.
Yeah, to have that megaphone.
That megaphone brought things way forward. And what a very smart way to introduce it. It's not lecturing. It's not hectoring. It's not shaming. It's plant some seeds in a garden and look how amazing God's green earth is. And gardening sales shot through the roof, seed sales shot through the roof. So a lot of people were doing it.
And you really
hadn't occurred.
Yeah, and you had a profound effect on the culture.
I think so.
How many times do you get a chance to do that?
Exactly. I think the profound effect maybe remains to be seen long term because, I mean, there has been a reduction in some of the indicators like diabetes and obesity, not as much as everyone would like to see. But these things, this is not a 5-year plan. It's a 50-year plan.
Yeah.
It took us a long time to get where we are in terms of processed food and our diet, and it'll take us a long time to get out of it.
Yeah, and you must have been aware, although it's probably didn't play much of a role in your job, you know, I mean, food insecurity is still a huge problem in America, which is kind of a terrible thing given how much wealth there is in this country.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's not a problem that's going to be fixed overnight.
Right.
And in the current climate with the current administration talking about cutting back on food stamps and, you know, it's sobering, you know.
It's very sobering. And it has long-term consequences. I think one of the things I like that Michelle Nichon used to say is when we would be told, well, we can't afford organic vegetables, which is true. They are high. And no one was really advocating, and certainly not in the White House, and even Michelle not saying you have to eat organic. Of course, it's better. But just make incremental changes little by little. And the thing that Dan Barber says that I always appreciate is there are hidden costs to the way we eat. The hidden costs in our health long term and in the impact on the environment.
Right. The health of the soil, the health of air.
Yeah. So, and I mean, when I left the White House, I went around the country and I gave a lot of college speeches on that science and cooking sort of subject, which was you go to a liberal arts college on a Friday night. We would fill auditoriums on the subject of science and food, which was amazing. I mean, I was like, aren't you supposed to be drinking in bars? But they weren't as profligate as I was in college. So I knew that we had, you know, ahead of vein, and that people were becoming very aware of of this issue. And I do think shows like yours, in general, the blogosphere, has really energized young people around this subject. And not necessarily because of food shows or gastronomy or French cooking, but they all relate it to the climate and to the planet in general,
mm-hmm.
and to the damage that the what we're doing now in terms of
food systems,
the runoff of fertilizer, you know, with this dead spot in the Caribbean. And I'm from where I'm from. There is half the of Lake Erie, which is a very shallow lake, is dead and toxic in the summertime because of this overgrowth of algae, of
wow.
toxic algae. And, it's
and Lake Erie is not a small lake.
It's not a small lake. They call it the Great Lake for a reason. And it's, but it happens to be somewhat shallow. I mean, 20, 30 feet, sunlight penetrates pretty far down, and it's producing this toxin. So they couldn't even drink their own water. Water that has been gone through the plant, they couldn't drink it. It reminds me of traveling to, just after the White House, I was sent with the State Department on one of these culinary diplomacy trips. They have Mrs. Clinton started this great program. And I went to Uzbekistan, and we did talks with college students and culinary students. It's a fascinating place. But they lost an entire sea because when the Soviets were administering their agriculture, they used this entire sea for irrigation, the Aral Sea. It's gone. It's not coming back. And what's left is this powdery substance, which was left from draining basically an entire sea. It was one of the largest lakes,
like
the
Mediterranean, but it was a...
yeah. But now it's empty, and this dust now is sort of whisked over huge swaths of the country that is semi-contaminated. So, I mean, it's one of the real ecological disasters of the last 25 years.
And there are so many. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen Wasted, the film that just came out.
Yes, yeah.
And it's really, I have to say that, you know, I've always believed in all this stuff. But when I saw Wasted and I saw the numbers and that I saw how many years it takes to break a head of lettuce down in a landfill, and when it came up that it was 25, I was like, I really have to start paying very much closer attention, because the impact is staggering. The effects on all of us are going to be hitting us right in the head.
These are choices. It's not really, although there's a lot of science there, it's not really rocket science. Although I just read last week in the Times about there was this mystery of why methane is increasing so quickly in the atmosphere, and they've related it now to livestock.
Yeah.
That the way we're raising livestock is producing this methane, which is even more nociferous than
carbon. So what's your most enduring memory about working in the Obama White House?
Oh, good. Let's get off this subject anyway.
I'm just kidding. Happy to talk about it.
No, we can, but it gets depressing. My most enduring memory of working in the White House, there was many small moments with both first families, you know, especially the Bushes at the end. It's very moving when their time there comes to an end, and although I think it was a relief, as it was for the Obamas. But, gosh, so many. I mean, many personal moments of them sharing downtime with family and friends when they do get a slight respite. Thanksgiving for the Obamas was big because they could invite family and friends, and there was no public events scheduled that day. Likewise for the Bushes, there were family events, and Mrs. Bush's mother used to come, and they would just have a small group gathering. Those are the – when they just get a chance to breathe. And, you know, I mean, we're chefs. We're on the other side of the wall. They're the ones that facing all the maelstrom. But you can kind of feel it, and you have great empathy for that job and how hard it is, how hard they work, how just difficult it is to face the kind of scrutiny that they have. It's a fishbowl.
Did they ever share a moment where you got under the veneer of, you know, they're playing a role, right? They're the first lady and the president. Like,
not really, no.
No.
Well, for the Bushes, as I said, they were seasoned
right
already.
Sure.
And plus, I came at the end of their administration, so they had closer contact and relationships with people who were there before. I'm not diminishing my fondness for them, but then the Obamas had just, when they first moved in, there is this period of, I would say, 6 weeks, maybe the first 100 days is the way to look at it, where their guard is a little down. I'll tell you a story that I've never told before. As I said, the president loved pies, and we became quite good at it. And so it became just a weekend thing. And then at the end of the 100 days, there's a press conference that is sort of where all the press come in and they sort of grill the president about, well, this is the 100-day mark now. What have you accomplished? And one of the questions was, what was the most enchanting thing about your first 100 days at the White House? And I saw him later that day, and he said, Bill, I swear to God, I was tempted to say the pastry chef, but he said, I knew I'd have to call a second press conference if I said that. But I do love those pies.
That's awesome. So, you know, when you left the mm-hmm. Obama White House, there was some talk that, you know, it was because of disagreements you were having with Michelle when she wanted you to bake more healthily. Doesn't sound like that was real.
Dude, I was on TMZ because of that.
Right.
No, that was totally fabricated by right-wing radio and a lot of... it was funny because, you know, we're not able to really evaluate nuance anymore,
which is too bad. Yes, because so the avalanche of fake news makes nuance impossible to identify.
There can be not. That whole thing came because Marion Burroughs, a great writer, started her story out with the line, Bill left the White House because of Mrs. Obama. In the Times, she announced that I was resigning. And the next line was, he was so inspired by her Let's Move initiative that he wanted to have greater impact outside of the White House.
But people ignored the first line.
Nobody reads the second line of an article. I mean, that's why podcasts are so great, because you sort of got them hooked a little bit. You hope they listen to at least the first 10 minutes.
Right.
So nuance is out the door. That, you know, that became a hook. And it actually got a lot of attention. And, you know, I hope it sells a lot of books.
Right.
Because it was nothing could be further from the truth. I was devoted to her and to her initiatives. And I hope, and this book is a proof of that, because we're trying to, I almost called it, instead of the sweet spot, I almost called it sweet knot. Because for me, what I love about a dessert is when, and I say this in the book, you use sugar as salt. You use it as it's meant to be used, which is an enhancer, but all the other flavors should still be present. So it's sweet not because the other flavors are there. So whether you're talking about a chocolate cake or an eclair, the taste of well-baked pâte à choux, of really good chocolate.
Which is the pastry people make into cream puffs. And...
Right, cream puffs and eclairs. I just pull that out of the hat because all those things are so often buried under sugar and fondant. And that's the point of this book, is that we are trying to really bring out those other flavors. And so we've introduced a lot of alternative grains, a lot of ingredients which are not typical of the larder, American larder. We have black sesame seeds and all kinds of floral and herbal treatments. But all of that, none of that works if you overload it with sugar.
Got it.
And so Peter Kaminsky, a fantastic writer and very funny,
good friend,
guy, is a wonderful way of communicating this. And I have to give a shout out also to Kathleen Hackett, who was our very much the equal partner in testing and in feedback on how to present it.
Recipe testing.
Recipe testing.
Got it.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So you talk in the book about the seven pillars of healthier desserts. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about less sugar, more whole grains, better full-flavored ingredients, no fake foods, and reduce fat, and then herbs, spices, and essential oils. These, it sounds like all of those came from your time at the White House, or were you already thinking about this before you were at the White House?
I think the White House crystallized it. Yeah, mm-hmm. it was definitely on my mind. And in hindsight, it's when I sort of started to pull those things together, because I had been doing it sort of unconsciously. And people may think, well, you know, we always say, well, the Obamas only had dessert once a week. But there can be 500 guests a day, so it's not like I was twiddling my thumb. I mean, we were baking a lot of food, making a lot of desserts. And
you're doing 500 covers a night.
Basically, yeah, or more. So we got a lot of chance to work out this idea. One thing also that I should emphasize is Mrs. Obama, or anyone who favors healthier lifestyle, I mean, it's not about deprivation. It's not about, oh, you can't have dessert. You have to, you know, only use, I don't know what, sugar replacements or no sugar or raw cooking, which is bogus. It's that if you're going to make a dessert, make it with great technique, great ingredients, small portion, and have it infrequently. And key to that, I think, is lowering the sugar content. So all of those things mean that we may never say that there's such a thing as a healthy dessert. There may not be.
Right.
But there is a healthy life with dessert.
Sure. There's a great quote in the book which you say, in order to enjoy pleasure-giving dessert that finishes off a great meal, just use the best ingredients with the best, often simplest techniques, and critically serve smaller portions. It turns out you can have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, I think so.
Is that Peter Kaminsky's turn of phrase or yours?
Oh, we had a mind meld there.
I see.
We
okay.
Just, yeah, we.
But it's true.
Much.
I mean, that's in a way, it's a first cousin of Julia Child's "All Things in Moderation."
Exactly. It's as simple as that, and it's been made very complex by how strident I think the conversation has become, and people are scared of eating anything.
Yeah.
And I'm not disavowing, and I'm not minimizing the toxicity of sugar. We know it is. It's been linked to, you know, cirrhosis
right.
of the liver. And I'm not minimizing that. But it's not only in desserts. I mean, the problem is it's in everything else.
Yes.
It's in processed food.
It's in mayonnaise.
So much. It's in mayonnaise. It's in medicine. So, I mean, that's where we're really, and the amounts are staggering. These, like, 64-ounce bottles of Coke are
right.
That's
mostly
murder
sugar.
In a jar.
Yeah. So, what are your three favorite desserts in the book?
I really got into sesame of all flavors. So there's several sesame desserts in there. Halva is an ingredient, and I love halva. I have for a long time. So the black sesame pudding, which is kind of daunting. I as I look back, it's kind of a complex dessert, but it's really good. I would say the Sheba from Queens, that is Peter. There's a like Queen of Sheba cake, which is a chocolate cake. We call it Sheba from Queens. My shop is in Queens. And I myself am a queen, so that
right.
seemed to work. So the
I didn't say that, but bada boom, go
bada
ahead.
Bada boom. That we made a chocolate cake with avocado as the fat, which may sound weird, but it gives an unctuous, rich, thick, sort of really rich texture and flavor to that cake, and we're very proud of that one. Many of them are fruit-based.
Yeah, what's like an easy fruit one?
That would be the strawberry trifle. It's kind of a strawberry tiramisu with lemon verbena cream. It has three elements. You put that together easily. Yeah. Oh, the Castella is a Japanese pound cake, which is really nice and very simple. One of the simplest desserts, but it's that kind of texture and flavor that is when flour and eggs bake together really well. It's a beautiful thing, and that's
got it.
That's all you need.
So before we get to the special sauce buffet, I want to talk to you about Sweeney Todd, because you're now baking every night
with
on
humans.
Stage.
Yes, that's right.
What so, the hell are you doing, girl?
I don't know. You know, it sort of launched a whole bunch of great headlines, like from the White House to the slaughterhouse, which is my favorite. Yeah, I make pies for Sweeney Todd. If you don't know the story, it's about a demon barber who kills his victims and hands them over to the pie shop downstairs where his cohort, Mrs. Lovett, cooks them
the pies. It's a feel-bad story.
It's absolutely the deliciousness of cannibalism. And her shop takes off and becomes extremely successful due to her special recipe. So when the producers were... They produced it first in London in a real pie shop, Harrington's, in Tooting, South London. And when they came to New York, they were looking for a pie shop. And my shop had just launched.
Right, which is called Perfect Pie.
Perfect Pie. Ours is an internet sales. You order our pies online. So we didn't really have a space where they could perform. They decided to go to the Barrow Street Theater, which is where they are now, and performing nightly. But they said, well, please do stay on and make the pies, which I'm doing and serving.
So this is a pie that you serve?
That is. That's the vegetarian version.
You brought me
pie. I certainly did.
You know, that means that ensures that you get to come back.
Oh, good, good. This is a this is a farmer's market sort of panoply of fruits, of corn and roasted tomatoes, tarragon, thyme, carrots, and
the crust
celery.
Is perfect, Bill.
Thank
I have
you.
To say.
Thank you.
I would eat this every night. But I shouldn't eat it anymore in the podcast.
It's hard to talk and eat at the same time.
So now it's time for the buffet, the special sauce, all-you-can-answer buffet. No pressure. No, we don't have any gongs that cut you short.
Mm-hmm.
Who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Could be artists. Could be people you've met. Could be painters.
Living and dead.
Somewhere in between.
Okay. Well, I want to invite my two favorite pastry chefs, who are Ho Chi Minh. Many people don't know that he was.
Ho Chi Minh was a pastry chef?
He was a pastry chef
That's
at the
right.
Ritz in Paris, because he had lived in Paris as a young man studying. The other one is Klaus Naomi, who was sort of a David Bowie type pastry chef before he was a rock star in the 80s. Antonin Carême, obviously. Those are the ones that come to mind first. I love opera, so I would like to have Puccini and Wagner.
Puccini and
there.
Wagner.
Yeah. Gloria Steinem, she's from Toledo, so we would have, plenty of things to discuss. My friend and partner in a project that we call Paper, Pen, and Palette, Ruta Dauphin, who is a fascinating lady here, lives in New York here, and she's the widow of Claude Dauphin, who was a French actor in the 60s in Two for the Road and many other great movies. She's a fascinating conversationalist. Oh, gosh. Am I up to, what do I get, 12?
You can have as many as you want, man.
Oh, okay. We have
Keep
a big
riffing,
table.
Dude. Yeah, we got a big table.
Well, obviously, Michelle Obama and Beyonce.
It's awesome. Now, did you ever get to meet Beyonce?
I spent some time backstage with her for Mrs. Obama's 50th birthday. And I must say, a most gracious stage mate.
You've led a good life, Bill.
I've led a good life.
Yeah, what would you be eating?
So I can't speak for the tastes of the other guests, so they're going to have to put up with my
right.
very
It's your supper,
particular.
I
love uni. I love sea urchin.
Okay.
So we'd have that
I like
somewhere
that.
Along the line. I think it should be catered by... The sky's the limit here, right?
Yeah.
Jiro. I think Jiro, we should fly him in.
I love
and
this.
And his fish. To,
I love this.
To do a sort of the crudo course. And then as an appetizer, I've been fantasizing about wild mushrooms lately. So
maybe a fricassee of wild mushrooms.
Of wild mushrooms.
All right.
That will get us started. And
main course?
We can, let's have a shellfish or two first. I love Dungeness crab. So... Douglas makes a great Dungeness crab.
Yes, he makes an amazing Dungeness crab with scallion and ginger.
Oh,
it's so awesome.
I've had it. It's insane.
And you've left out dessert.
Well, I haven't even got to the main course yet. I really love a lot of the game dishes that come out at this time of year. So, Daniel, I'm going to have to ask you to prepare the wonderful... Bekas.
This is Daniel Boulou.
Daniel Boulou.
Okay.
Is there another Daniel? Yeah, he makes just a wildly delicious bekas, woodcock, the little bird. which last time I checked was still okay to eat. I
mean, right. Hasn't gotten to the whether it's illegal or not.
So while I was kind enough to omit ortolans, I won't ask for those.
Which is a bird that is illegal to eat.
Yes, that one is definitely off the list. And for dessert, I'm a huge fan of pavlova, so I would like a fraise de bois pavlova with a homemade vanilla ice cream.
Wild strawberry
pavlova with ice cream.
Which we should explain is a meringue, basically.
Baked meringue, yeah, kind of crunchy meringue.
I want to come. This is a great dinner. So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Oh, good question. We always have dried pasta, and there's always some good cheese in the refrigerator. I have to do just what's in the fridge. I can't go out. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't do
yeah,
shopping.
I mean, dried pasta. If I'm, if I dig back in there, sometimes I have like the end of Botarga, which is mostly just the wax left. But
so you grate that.
It's good wax.
It's good wax. It's the best wax there is.
Good beeswax. Yeah, that's sort of like a prison meal.
Do you have a guilty pleasure? It's always interesting to ask the pastry chef whether he has a guilty pleasure.
All right, I'm going to be honest. I really do believe that, we need to source our food carefully and, but I can eat a Mounds bar.
Me too. I think Mounds are far superior to Almond Joy's.
Oh, I would agree. I would agree. Just Mounds. That's all.
Yeah, just straight up.
Yeah.
Like when we get Halloween candy for the kids in our building.
Yeah.
They're Mounds.
Good, really.
Because I want the leftovers.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're... I mean, it's as close to like a quality bonbon as you can find.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just been declared Bill Yosis Day. What's happening all over the world on that day?
People are going into the kitchen and cooking with their kids. That is my real mission in life now. And... my husband and I, Charlie Fabelia, we partner with some schools in New York, and we love getting kids cooking. We've had kids as young as 4 years old.
Wow.
We give them those little plastic knives. They can't do any harm. The problem is the helicopter parents. Like, Johnny, don't touch that. We have this program called Kitchen Garden Laboratory. We partner with a school in the Bronx, PS55. Steve Ritz is an amazing inspiration up there to kids and education and cooking. The principal, Luis Torres, is also a fantastic partner in that program. And we've been, we're proud to say we've been hired by the New York City Board of Ed to do what's called STEM Institute several times a year. In which teachers, public school teachers, can sign up for this 3-day program. There's other STEM sort of programs, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. Ours concentrates on bringing cooking into the classroom. So we do real-time cooking lessons, some of them even without any heat. You don't need to have even a burner, in which we use cooking to teach science. And this is an outgrowth of the classes that I've been doing at Harvard, the Science and Cooking program. Up there, I work with a young man who's a biochem PhD candidate, Vayu Mani Rekdal, and we cook and do science.
That's awesome. So that's what would be happening. Like, everyone would be cooking with their kids, just all over.
Cooking with your kids.
No school, no work, no anything.
Oh, I like school. So you can do it. You can maybe a half day of school.
Oh, whoa, man, you're tough. All right. Thank you so much, Bill, for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Ed. This was really fun.
For sharing your special sauce. Check out Bill's new book, The Sweet Spot, Dialing Back Sugar and Amping Up Flavor. And if you find yourself in New York City in the near future, go see Sweeney Todd and have a pie.
And no matter where you are, you can order a pie from perfectpie.com.
Exactly.
Our internet
sales. And his pies are serious. So, and I bet your pies are as good as the play.
Yeah. It's a different sensory experience.
Yeah, you can't say that.
I can't sing, I can't dance, and I can't act.
But all right.
I can make a pie.
Anyway, thanks, Bill, and we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters. Thank you.